Meditation is a daily reprieve. It has restorative values for us. It boosts our immune system. We get a chance to recenter ourselves. Perhaps we receive some inner guidance. There's a letting go and detachment from distractions. We can ask ourselves during this process, who is it and what is it that we're connecting to? So Theosophy offers that we have a septenary constitution. And Patanjali tells us we have to get all those ducks in a row, really, to get into a good meditative state. We have to take care of our bodies. We have to restrain our kamic or desire nature. We have to look and see if we're projecting, you know, ourselves into our observations of others and giving it a fair shake. We have to put aside our mind, you know, in our brains. And the daily practice helps us to develop a strength so that it's easier when we do it on a regular basis. And then when we really need it, like now, it's there. It's a muscle that we've developed, just like walking. And it gets easier and easier to do. So some of the questions that might come up that are valuable to us in the practice of meditation. What can we really change about ourselves and our perspective? Because it's really a break from looking outside, you know. As we take in our day, we're receiving a lot of input. But when we quiet ourselves and with practice look inward and connect to our higher nature, we can ask ourselves questions like, what is our relationship to the karma of different situations? Are we forcing a situation instead of accepting how it's unfolding under karmic law? Is there a chance that we might be in the problem as opposed to in the solution? Are we shirking our responsibilities to our families, to our friends, our sangha, or to ourselves? Are we acting out based on past tendencies of our ancestors? Now, we have family skandhas that we've inherited, and sometimes they come out and play a big role in our behavior. And we have habits that have been passed down to us from religious organizations we may have belonged to in past lives, who knows? And they might be affecting us in ways we don't realize. This one I like very much. Are we challenging ourselves to grow? Are we keeping ourselves in our comfort zone? Because we know the purpose of life is to learn, and we need to get out of our ruts. We need to get out of our comfort zone so we can learn and grow. Sometimes our habits just need a reordering. Are they growing stale and gathering dust? Are we getting a little bit moldy? Are we rationalizing our behavior by bringing it these lofty motives and then succumbing to hurtful means to force solutions? It's like Arjuna in the chariot with his whole family drawn up in the battle lines around him. We might think that, what is karma doing? But actually, everything is taken care of under law. And we need to have a faith in that. Are our perceived injustices real? Are we transferring our crappy day to others, you know, just mindlessly? Are we developing a meditation of a lifetime? Theosophy talks about Patanjali's. Are we in balance and aligned with our goals? Speaking of Patanjali, he tells us that there are, in the first book, two types of meditation. The regular practice on a daily basis of meditation. And then the second form is the meditation of a lifetime. And that's the sum total of habits. We're in a walking meditation. Our life is a walking meditation. And the teachings have helped me to realize to be mindful, to be grateful, especially right now during the pandemic. Boy, being able to take a walk with my dog and enjoy the beautiful flowers, this just the sunshine, not taking for granted, hugging and touching, which we can't do right now, but thinking back and saying, gosh, the things I complained about before the pandemic seem like noise right now. We're just grateful to be alive. Then Patanjali tells us that if we assert ourselves assiduously and we practice meditation and we clear out the distractions, we can start to reflect on the moral qualities and add these to our meditation. Are we able to be there for others in a way that helps them? Do we try to force meditative practices that we've developed on other people? I mean, some people have a really rough time meditating. They might need a walking meditation for a while or some help to get there. But Patanjali's, Mr. Judge tells us, gives the best instructions to meditation, because everyone is different. And ultimately, it's a tall order, you know, to follow the instructions of Patanjali's, because we have to have our house in order. And that takes time and it takes work. We have to have our physical body need to be taken care of, so that they can receive the benefits of meditation and don't distract us with our aches and pains. And, you know, we have to have this and that done. We have to have our family life in a relatively good place. We want to work on that so that we're in as good a place as we can be. We need to not be distracted by the itties and the cities. And all of that, what is our motive, you know, in our actions during the day? So we want to create a strong house. Are brains able to focus and concentrate? They're an organ too. Are our minds focused in a concentration that helps us to clear the space to make room for that voice in the silence, that connection that's beyond the brain, beyond the mind, to our Buddhic nature, to our soul nature.
But later on when we need to plug it in, just
someone's not so can hear muted.
Okay.
And we can hear your conversation. Thank you. If you could all just mute yourselves.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you. So, thank you. In the final, the most advanced stages of meditation, book four, we're assured that if we do or perform all of our tasks for the Supreme Self, every fiber of our being will be turned into perfect concentration. So just as in chapter 10, the lighting up of the Supreme One becomes visible to us. We make a connection. And we are encouraged that if we meditate on that which in us is the highest self, we will be able to obtain a concentration and be able to work with our entire being for and as the self of all creatures, which is sometimes we hear it as we can devote all of our actions then on a regular basis as a practice to acting in accord with the law. Life becomes easier. People talk about it in terms of what is God's will for us in this situation. God is the Supreme Spirit, has a role in life. It's not all about us. There's a beautiful pageant, a spiritual pageant, an evolutionary one that's unfolding itself before us every day. And we might not perceive it, but it's there. And so we develop the meditation of a lifetime. And then it can become more automatic for us and brings great protection, better connections, more lessons, of course, and it becomes easier as time goes on, as we said, so that we don't have to suffer, you know, perhaps as much. Instead, we can be uplifted, have a better perspective on the experiences, and be there in a much more wholesome, productive, and enlightened way. And so there are enormous benefits to this practice. It doesn't have to be complicated. It doesn't, you don't have to follow this, that, or the other. There are idiosyncrasies that people have to practice, and we need to connect with those and understand that, and have a basic outline, a wonderful outline in Patanjali's yoga aphorisms, maybe the best one that's out there at the moment. So I think that's good for me, Steve.
Okay. Just a reminder, especially if you're on a phone, to mute your system. If you're having difficulty, you can let us know and we can help you move your system. So at this time, I'd like to invite all to participate. So if they have any questions or comments, then particularly to direct them to the issue of the value of daily meditation. So are there any questions, comments at this time?
Yes, I had a question.
Go ahead,
Helena asked, are we able to be there for others? And my question was, how can we do that while we're being isolated and apart from others?
So the question is, how can we be there for others when we're isolated from others at this time? And that's a good question. Actually, I've participated in a lot of Zoom meetings, conferences, seminars. Of course, it takes a little bit of learning, you know, to get onto Zoom, but actually we were headed in that direction anyway. You know, the technology was there and developing. We've just accelerated. And thank God we're able to use it. Imagine if we didn't have all this technology, how would we have communicated an epidemic to each other? And who knows how many millions of lives are going to be saved because doctors and healthcare providers and counselors can share very valuable information, which they couldn't do during the 1918 pandemic and previous ones. People probably noticed that they were getting sick and falling down and dying and said, oh my gosh, there's something going on. But now we can do so much to counteract the full effects of this pandemic going unchecked. We can communicate all around the world. And even though in New York we had a horrific experience, we took the brunt of it. we were learning the whole time and sharing our learning with others so they didn't have to go through it as badly as we did. So there's that. What can we do on a personal basis? Well, I've been thinking the same thing. I mean, it's a meditative time. I think we all get extra time to meditate and adjust and think about what kind of practices we do engage in. And then we've reached out to people who have families who might not be close to them, just making phone calls, setting up these classes. I was so happy to see people who came to the lodge, and we weren't sure what shape they would be in, you know, if they were coming back, did they have the coronavirus, were they in the hospital? And so many people said it was a relief to see the email inviting them to a theosophy class when they got home from the hospital, because they did have the coronavirus and managed to survive it. So we're keeping our fingers crossed. So making phone calls. I mean, everybody has, I think, a way that they can give in their own unique way. We all represent an aspect of that universal mind and self. And I do believe that we're like neurons in the brain, and we're all able to channel some aspect of that one deific essence to contribute. We all have a contribution to make. For some people, it might be we're Zooming cooking classes or art therapy or musical concerts. So many of the musicians came out and are performing for free. We have a lot more time on our hands, and there's still a lot more to do. We're probably just halfway through this, but I hope that helped on some level.
CBW.
Yes, it did. Thank you very much.
CBW?
Yes, CBW.
Could someone explain the term symposium? What I've been able to gather, it's not new, and that it goes back in time. So it has a distinct purpose. What is that purpose of holding symposia?
Thank you. So we might phrase that this way for the presenter. Keeping in mind perhaps the meaning of significance of symposia, would it be kind of a group meditation?
Group meditation.
We're asking the Helena.
Yes.
Thank you, Steve, for taking me off the hook. No, there is a value to coming together, and I think that's part of the karma of this situation as well. I don't think there's any one of us who enjoys this isolation. After a while, there's a part of our nature that really needs to connect to other people, and I think that's being brought into a sharp focus that we were meant to form these connections to each other. And when a group comes together, it has its own energy that it creates. Each of us are channeling an aspect of that one life. And when it comes together, the vibration is higher when we come together. And that electromagnetic energy of gathering has been spoken of in the scriptures, wherever two or more of you are gathered in my name, I am there also. So there are bridges beyond the physical. There must be seven different types of connections that we can have to each other. And there's a power you know, there's a power of a group coming together, and that energy goes out. If a pebble that's tossed into a pond can reverberate through the whole pond, imagine what a few people come together like this could send out, and that might be of service as well.
Thank you. Do we have another question or comment? Yes. Unmute yourself.
Is meditation a tool which we have to use to gain spiritual knowledge?
Is meditation a tool which we have to use to gain spiritual knowledge? It's an important tool. I would have to say that it holds a very high place in our practices. I mean, really, it's a way to define a lot of different relationships that we have. The relationship to our understanding of who we are is an important one. If we don't understand who we are, I mean, sometimes people think, why do we have to go over our composite nature? Well, if we can name it and we can label it, it becomes much easier to understand what we're operating under. The same way with meditation, I believe when we elaborate and identify the nature of meditation and the value of meditation, then we form a groove of life that we can connect to. I know people who strive and strive to meditate, and they hit all kinds of walls, and they can't do what everybody else can do. We have to think about that too, that sometimes people have different forms and ways that they engage in the meditation of a lifetime. You know, some people, it will be taking care of horses. Some people, it will be owning a bakery. For some people, it will be taking care of children. For some people, it will be healing. But all of those different aspects represent, I believe, a connection and a mindfulness. And when people don't have that connection, they struggle. They really, really struggle. So they just feel like they're not in sync with life, and they become suicidal, they become depressed, they become anxious, overcome with grief and trauma. So knowing how to balance that out, how to restore ourselves, our souls, how to connect to this practice, I think does a world of good for anyone who comes in touch with it. It can be an enormous saving grace for all of us, I think.
Thank you. Is there another question or comment?
Yes, may I ask a question?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
We hear you very well.
Yes, thank you. Okay, could it possibly be that the ability to be successful in your meditation could be an aptitude that you brought back from another life, from many other lives of attempting to do it and just building on it and building on it, to the point where you are able to be able to meditate better than someone who's just starting on the path now? Is there a karmic component to it? That's the question.
Thank you, Anthony. There is absolutely a karmic component to meditation, which is, they say you can't take it with you when you die, but this is something that you can take with you when you die. the practices that we develop, the habits that we develop, they actually are waiting for us in the skandhic bundles when we come back. So I imagine if we were, perhaps we see this in one lifetime, to have certain handicaps, and we invested in meditation in a past life, and we might be able to be cheerful while we're undergoing, you know, those types of character building experiences that are our higher self feels that we need to develop. So there are, the more that we invest in habits and routines, the less likely we are to surround ourselves with that negative energy that attracts negative circumstances to us. So we set up an electromagnetic type of a pattern.
What you want to make sure is that your microphone is muted, though.
Yes, there is every opportunity to come to terms with the past during our lifetimes, our family's past. We contribute to our family karma, our social karma, our national karma, our group karma. As students, I'm sure we've probably been studying together in past lifetimes as well. And so we end up in classrooms together. So we're sowing the seeds for the future in the present all the time. And I think the teachings make that so abundantly clear to us that we can be more of a captain of our own ship and propel ourselves forward, use the rudders that people aren't even aware that they have. Some people just get swept along with the tide, but actually we can learn to navigate, you know, our vessels and our experiences within life and successfully, more successfully. And then the fruits of that will be enjoyed.
Thank you. We have time for another question or comment. Well, we have a question, if there isn't any. Why might there be the misconception that theosophy does not offer too much in a practical way on meditation, since most of its meetings have to deal with the consideration of philosophical and ethical principles, practical in everyday life? Why might there be the idea that meditation is not as important in theosophy?
So why so much emphasis on morals and ethics in theosophy? Well, they are actually the biggest gatekeepers to our spiritual life. And so the consequences karmically cause an effect that we reap over the course of a life. Once we become aware of it, we're much more mindful of the causes we're setting up and able to assess that some of these are the effects from the past and create our own path through them. But if we're going to connect to our soul life, which ultimately we must, you can avoid it if you want and be very self-centered and self-focused, but it's gonna get you into trouble morally and ethically. There will be consequences. I remember a reference to karma as a great diaphragm, and we throw our behavior, our motives, our intentions, our feelings up against this diaphragm, and it comes back to us. And at some point in life, we realize that there is this law that's operating. And if we work across purposes to it, the outcome isn't very good. It can be much more difficult. Whereas if we really align ourselves and act in accordance as best we can with these laws, these spiritual and ethical and moral laws, we have much to gain. Then when we make that connection to the higher self, we're able to channel intuitively all the essence of learning, not just of ourselves in our past lives, but we're actually able to channel the omniscience, the all-knowing, the all-perceiving, just the way that Arjuna saw Krishna in chapter 10 in the Gita. We have a chance to open up to a world, an encyclopedic, all-pervasive knowledge and understanding that we could use in our daily lives. So, for example, if I'm thinking really hard about the virus, and I get out of my way, and I detach, and I create an open space, and connect to my higher self, or higher power, whatever you want to call it, I may be inspired, you know, by and attract information that will help me to perform as a helper or healer. Where do we draw our inspiration from? And if we align ourselves morally and ethically, we open ourselves up to a much, much broader universal understanding and connection to life, but we also draw on universal mind, which we can't do unless we start to think universally and act for and as the self of all creatures. Then we only have our limited mind that we can draw from. And that is limiting, you know, that is less inclusive and will probably, or possibly will, we see this with rigid personalities. They're set in their own ways and their own way of thinking. And then when it comes to having to solve a problem, and they keep hitting their head up against the wall, they haven't been able to expand their perspective to include solutions because it's the same old, same old. So being able to stretch our elastic and get out of our comfort zones, open ourselves up to the highest and the best in us, benefits us in so many ways. And that's just one of them. And that's just one of them.
Thank you. Thank you to the student from New York for helping us set a great tone for this symposium. And from the gist of that last answer, we can appreciate the value of meditation. But if we don't have the right motive, intention, knowledge, the meditation will not be as useful or beneficial to ourselves as we might expect. So our next aspect of the symposium then is to get into some of those foundation universal principles, those fundamental aspects of the teachings of theosophy, and explore their particular application to the subject of the meaning and method of meditation. So our next presenter, who will also handle the questions and comments, is a student associate from the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia, who will present a talk on the foundation of meditation. Thank you.
Thank you. In order to fully explore meditation in the light of theosophy, it is imperative that we share common vocabulary, concepts, and premises with which to consider and communicate, whether we are, quote, old-timers or newcomers, we need that common core. Frequently heard in theosophy halls around the world are presentations of the three fundamental propositions upon which the entire philosophy rests. All three are merely aspects of one truth, and that is that all in manifestation originates from the absolute. It might also be known as the unknowable, the infinite, the uncreate, the eternal beingness, the all, Atma. it is what stands behind Joseph Campbell's Masks of the Divine. Both the concepts of space and of abstract, absolute motion are used to ponder this oneness in both the macrocosm of the universe and cosmos and the microcosm, man. In The Key to Theosophy on page 29 appears the following concerning the microcosm, the human state. Quote, the divine spark in man, being one and identical in its essence with the universal spirit, our spiritual self is practically omniscient, but cannot manifest its knowledge owing to the impediments of matter. Further on page 43 of The Key, we find the statement that matter, deprived of its soul and spirit or its divine essence, cannot speak to the human heart. The root of all nature, objective and subjective, and everywhere else in the universe, visible and invisible, is, was, and ever will be one absolute essence from which all starts and into which everything returns. The philosophy of theosophy offers much information on the correspondences between the cosmos and the soul experiencing the human state. Each soul is operating through conditions generated by karma, maintained by various skandhas. What is called buddhi manas shines over all. Manas, mind, may be quite latent in the waking state of physical man and may be extremely affected by kama, the desire principle. In the human state, the soul can use the brain in wondrous but limited functions to think, to observe, to perceive, to use logic and reason. Each one of us has within the core of soul the impress, the intuitive sense that I am that I am. There comes with it a confidence in the fact that states of consciousness can be created, altered, used. On page 232 of Answers to Questions, Robert Crosby wrote this: true knowledge has to be gained through an increasing perception of the universality of law and the universal line of progress for every being of whatever grade. That deeper knowledge of all things is latent in the soul of every human being. Only as we think and act from that basis shall we realize these great truths. The duality of the human state is thus the man who is the one who thinks and the one who records. The foundation of meditation, as presented in the philosophy, is the concept that resident within the illusion of the personal human, within the body and the brain, is the one, the ray, an unchanging witness, a perceiver, observer, spectator of all changes. The wise man is, as a cultural anthropologist, a participant observer in the electric ocean of life. We do observe different modes of thought, planes of consciousness, feelings, moods, fancies, because there is this eternal ray of the absolute within our inner nature. There is far more to us than the rubber ruler of transitory thinking. That eternal, unchanging witness is the true measurer of all passing experiences. It is from the spiritual or soulful foundation that modifications can be viewed and considered. Discernment can be achieved by practicing the art of living, the science of life. No matter whether we read the Bhagavad Gita, the Gita notes, or Patanjali's yoga aphorisms, we see the same one foundation for meditation being taught, one truth. As the ray of the absolute, now enmeshed in the conditionality of incarnation, the true immortal self empowers, informs, garners all experiences, makes meaning, transmutes. The ray is as Krishna is to Arjuna on the pages of the Gita. That ray may be intensified, realized, or made real on this waking plane through the diligent use of a lifetime's meditation, through the devotional practice of sitting for intentional periods of meditation, and most certainly in the synthesis of the deep sleep state. We can use the analogy of the hydrologic cycle to fully explore the foundation from which we meditate. H2O is the abstraction, the universal solvent of life. As such, H2O does not change, although its embodiment on this plane does. Water appears to vary. The gaseous state might be steam or vapor. The liquid state might be fresh, brackish, or saline. The solid state, ice or snow. But H2O is what it remains to be. The ray of the absolute animating the human is. It, as all else in manifestation, is sevenfold. Using the Buddhistic and psychological process of, quote, shaving, we can divest the mind of its lower attributes and moods. If only we can center in the human state, remain one-pointed, generate a heart open in compassion and harmony to the true source behind manifestation, we can maximize the potential for the spiritual, the eternal, to become real on this plane, to meditate fully, and to do it for each and all, a compassionate, altruistic service in the now.
Thank you. We'll now open it up to your questions and comments specifically on this idea of the foundation of meditation being not only in universal principles as offered in theosophy, but also that foundation being recognizing what is universal in all human beings. Michael? Michael? Yeah.
Can you unmute me? Can you
hear
me?
We can hear you.
Oh, good. The foundation of meditation, it doesn't stand alone. There's other ingredients that lead up to it. And we're talking about will and concentration. So how do these all work together, will, concentration, and meditation?
Well, the question about will and concentration and meditation, I believe, is going to be handled in later talks. But the premise, the foundation here in this philosophy is that as a thinker, as a personality, as an incarnate entity, we have the ability to think in very low, emotional, perhaps moody ways in the lower mind, in the monkey mind. And we also have the potential to calm that and gradually through a practice that we'll be discussing more fully today, to begin to concentrate, to focus our mind, to consider inspirational, if you will, scripture, maybe music or art or symbols or poetry. There are many, many different triggers for gradually focusing on far more than the mundane events of daily life. And so as the earlier speaker was talking about developing a muscle, we develop a habituated effort of calming the physical, calming the brain, calming the emotional nature, and turning to a particular focus of mindful and soulful meditation. But the essence, the ability to do that, is resident in the teaching that the true nature of self is spiritual. It is soulful. It is not the physical, the transitory.
Thank you. And just a reminder to everyone to mute your microphone if you're not speaking or answering a question. Are there any other questions or comments?
Yes, GBW.
Go ahead.
Could we have a reading of the declaration, the first couple of paragraphs, the policy?
Well, let's look at that in terms of what ideas in the declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists give us a foundation for meditation. Handle it that way.
Well, I don't have a copy right in front of me, so we'll do this from memory. And I'll ask all of you to be the wind beneath my wings, so to speak. The essence of the declaration, based on the true nature of self, a profound and deep understanding and conviction of universal brotherhood, that all in manifestation, not only soul in the human state, but every conditioned experience of whatever degree of intelligence, consciousness in manifestation, all of that is an array of oneness. It is all akin. It is all an emanation, a coming forth from that absolute, the basis for compassionate and absolutely unconditioned love and oneness. And so in that notion, where the entire declaration, it's just a few pages, but think of the 24 sites where there are actually theosophy halls around the world. Think of all the independent students, many of them with us today, who reside in a state or a country where there is no lodge, there is no study center, but they are attending or associated with other centers and other students and other facilities. All of that effort of volunteerism is based on that ethical, moral, spiritual comprehension of what it is, what the Dharma is, to be soul passing through the human state, using that human state in its dynamic and creative sense to uplift all that's in manifestation. And those concepts appear in the declaration.
Another question?
Yes.
Can you please go ahead. Marion?
Yes. In the declaration, it talks about independent devotion to the cause of theosophy. So that would go along perfectly with this idea of meditation, because it's definitely independent. And the continued practice of it would definitely benefit the cause of theosophy.
Thank you for that comment about independent devotion. frankly, if we got to know each other personally, we'd see major themes of independence and strength of conviction and commonalities in which we have a confidence, almost a faith in our ability to learn and progress and to verify things for ourselves. And that is devotional. That is one-pointed. That can be practiced independently of each other, especially if we are dedicating particular times where we're sitting in the practice of meditation in the morning and in the evening. But it can also be practiced, we can be a hermit even as we move through our daily lives in the sense of being a participant observer. We're in the world, we're not of the world. We're in the same ocean of life and problems as everyone else, but we're in our own boats. And yet we paddle together, don't we? Here we are this morning, practicing the most mystical of processes. We don't even stop to consider often all of the powers, all of the arrays of degrees of processing and substance that we bring together when we listen to one another, when we envision what the other is saying, when we use symbols of sound and intonation and words, and then we share back feedback and share and generate new ideas together. That's a form of group meditation. But further, toward the end of the declaration is the invitation that all who are in the true service of humanity, any soul struggling to understand what it is to free human nature, struggling to find a way to serve a solution that will bring peace and harmony and fellowship to all mankind, to all entities in nature. They're self-fulfilled and self-devised methods, yes. But we are informed in the declaration that we are to fit ourselves by study, certainly book learning, certainly in a symposium like now where we're learning from and with each other, but also to fit ourselves otherwise. And that would include character development. That would include making the effort to meditate on the highest we can imagine as an aspiration for what the human state can be and what it would mean if we could completely flesh out the terms of the Kuan Yin pledge so that we're uplifting each and all.
Yes, go ahead, Tom.
Well, as far as the declaration serving as the foundation of a meditation, there was a comment or discussion a little earlier of do we gain in spiritual knowledge by meditating? And that made us think, well, by meditating, certainly we open up ourselves so that the spiritual knowledge probably can flow through a little more clearly. And then if we look at the portion of the declaration where it says the exemplification in practice of those principles. So if we are routinely meditating and living our life in practice of those principles, really then the declaration is pointing to the lifetime's meditation.
Yes.
To keep it coming wherever we are, whatever we're doing, have that operating in the back of our mind and using it as the foundation for what we're doing.
Thank you for that contribution. That lifetime's meditation, the notion that we can practice metacognition in any one moment of our lives. We can observe a mood, a reaction, a sensation, a memory, and we don't have to get lost in it. We don't have to completely become honed to that transitional kind of thinking, but rather moment to moment, we can set the ideal and the goal, the real goal for ourselves, that in any moment we will try to be as mindfully cognizant as we possibly can, that we are consistently 24/7 on guard, so that we are moving our character development from selfish through self-centered to selfless in the process of living, so that we walk our talk, so that philosophically the tenets that we hold true become the basis and the foundations for thought, word, and deed throughout the course of our day, both directed toward ourselves and directed in gentle kindness to others. And again, that's key, and that's a different form of meditation that's not light years away, but is something that can be practiced, that something that is possible and something that we can habituate within our daily efforts.
A question that comes up regarding the foundation of meditation. We think for many people, when they meditate, they're meditating from the point of view of their personal understanding of who and what they are, identifying with themselves as personalities with certain stressors, limitations, strengths. They have a relatively limited perspective in their meditation. But from what was presented, it seems as though the meditation offered from a theosophical perspective is learning how to take consciously the perspective that we are the perceiver, we are the observer, which doesn't have any personal attributes. It is, it's the witness. Could you speak to how we can begin to develop that foundation of meditating from the perspective of the impersonal perceiver and not from our understanding of ourselves as personalities?
Earlier in the comments was mentioned the shaving process. And so one exercise that we can do for ourselves as part of a calming or a centering, a defining, if you will, is to determine I am that I am that. And it's a very simple process that can be taught to any child, and they get a big chuckle out of it. They recognize the value of it. I am not only someone's child. I'm not only someone's sister, mother, cousin, niece. And we can go all the way through the process. I'm not the body. I'm not this mood. I'm not this impulse. I'm not this compulsion. I'm not this worry. I'm not this limited, lowly thinker. And in the process of going through that, we gradually get closer and closer to the recall that we have when we first wake up in the morning. Before our heads come off the pillow, before we recall, I'm so-and-so, and I have these duties for the day, and I've got those worries on my plate. Before all of that comes in mentally is the sense of existence, pure being, I am. It's the same sensation that a patient waking up from a coma still has, that an amnesiac has, that all of us share, I am. And by beginning to focus on that, by using the shaving process and putting all these assigned roles and aspects down, we begin to strengthen. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. I am soul. I am spiritual. I am the spectator. I am changeless. And all of this all of this will also pass.
So the idea there was the reason that we're not those things is because those things change all the time.
They all change.
They come and go, but the observer, the perceiver is permanent and therefore spiritual and universal. That's what we need to find out, which doesn't change.
It doesn't change. It is the permanent static ruler that measures all other changes. It doesn't flex. It's not an opinion. It's not a passing fancy. It's not a particular role we're playing at any one time. It's a permanence by which we can judge and gain discernment and gain insight. It's not limiting. It's that container theory that we learn about in sociology and psychology, where how we define our role, how we limit our self-image to just the physical and the personal and the aging and the limited, the weakness. It's far and above that, far and above all karmic attributes.
Any other questions? Michael?
Well, can we say then it's simply consciousness?
At the highest source, it is pure consciousness. If you double check, it's around page 171 to 175 in the key, where HPB is discussing the proper terms for the proper items, and she gets into the sevenfold principles that we use to contact the planes and the states of consciousness. The higher self that is above everything certainly is pure consciousness. So pure that it would be part of the collective in many ways, without attributes in itself, akin to the abstract notion of H2O. And then at every aspect of every principle, at every plane of existence, we have more and more defined or delineated radiance of that pure consciousness. So where we are now in soul and finite bodies and finite brains, we're using the very lowest attributes, if you will, of mind and passion, the lower ego. But within, beyond that, there is a pure mind being and degrees of abstraction leading up to the purest notion of spirit, of divinity or deity that we can imagine on this plane.
So we have time for another question or comment, if there's any. Well, thank you to the student and associate from Philadelphia. From what we heard from the foundation of meditation and also from the principles and the declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists, the aim of all of it is to gain a truer realization of the self, the true self, and a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. So this brings us to our next session, which will be conducted by an associate and student from the Lodge in London, Ontario, Canada. And this student will begin with a talk on the focus of meditation. Now we're meditating, what should be our focus?
Okay. Yes, what should be the focus of our meditation? It was mentioned about meditation and theosophy, and that Theosophy doesn't really give us any, doesn't talk too much about meditation. And actually, Theosophy is meditation. It is the ocean that we are swimming in. And we're not very good swimmers. And we are trying to learn how to manage our instrument. And in that process, we forget who we are. So Theosophy indicates that there are elder brothers who watch over the progress of the less progressed. That there are beings with greater awareness than us, as there are beings with less awareness. So Theosophy holds these adepts, these elder brothers, these great teachers, as a focus for us. We see that it is possible to manage our lower nature, that the 45 fires, that the 45 fires or 49 fires that we live in are manageable, that we can begin to discern ourselves as the self and begin the process of getting our instruments under control. So just a moment, I'm going to turn this off just in case I get interrupted again. I'm technology here. This is called the power of concentration here, right here. The biggest distractor we have. Okay, power off. Okay, there we go. So the elder brothers of humanity, to set the tone again away from that interruption, let's look at what Mr. Judge says in his article on Hit the Mark, Oh Friend. Having taken the bow, the great weapon, let him place it on the arrow, sharpened by devotion. Then, having drawn it with a thought, directed to that which is, hit the mark, O friend. The indestructible Om is the bow. The self is the arrow. Brahman is called its aim. It is to be hit by a man who is not thoughtless. And then, as the arrow becomes one with the target, he will become one with Brahman. Know him alone as the self and leave off all other words. He is the bridge of the immortal. Meditate on the self as Om. Hail to you that you may cross beyond the sea of darkness. That's from the Mundaka Upanishad. So the nature of this self is, like Mr. Judge will indicate, the nature of the sun. And we're told to meditate on the idea of the sun and what it means. And in that regard, we begin to see that we too, like the sun, can shine light through all conditions. That we are not limited by any condition that we find ourselves in, but that through those conditions, we can begin to shine the light of the higher self. So how do we know if we're shining the light of this higher self? How do we know if that's what's coming forth in the sevenfold nature of our being? And the declaration indicates that it is through that desire to help others that we begin to control and put to rest all the other desires that we hold. When we go to work in the morning, we can go to work thinking about, oh, it's going to be fun, or I'm going to get to talk with everybody. Or we can go to work thinking about, I want money to pay my bills. Or we can think about going to work so that we can go on a holiday next month. But Theosophy indicates, and the Bhagavad Gita indicates, that's not who we are. And we're doing nothing when we do those things. That we're not acting at all. That the real self that we are is like a bird trapped in a cage and it can warble not. The only time that bird can get out of its cage, that self that can begin to act, is when we have a desire to help others. When we let go of all the many desires that haunt us and nip at our heels and drag us down. And we begin to focus on that service to all that lives, that Kuan Yin pledge that was mentioned. It was also mentioned in earlier that what can we do while we're in isolation? What are some of the things that we can do to help others? And of course, at this point in time, the best way to help others is to stay out of the way as best we can physically. But there is another way that we can help others. And we know that the masters of wisdom are peopling the higher astral currents with the highest thoughts and the most beneficent thoughts. And so we can do the same thing. In our isolation, we can study and meditate upon high themes, not having feeling sorry for ourselves, not thinking about what we can't do or what we'd like to do, but actually to take the ideas that are presented by Theosophy and give them life in our minds, and to lift up. And when we lift up our thoughts and our feelings to this idea of service, to this idea of the elder brothers, we are told that we raise up all of nature, that we raise up each other. The word symposium comes from the Greek, which means to drink together. And so we are drinking together from universal mind. And by doing it together, it becomes easier for each one of us. And so as each one of us prepared for today's symposium, to whatever degree that we could, we are in a process of evolution, of raising up matter. And nature unaided fails, and we are the ones, the bridge between the higher principles and nature itself. So we have to walk that walk. We have to begin to do that work. So as the Bhagavad Gita says, we do nothing in eating and drinking and sleeping. That's not who we are. It's our attitude that we shine through our actions. It's the sun, the light that we shine through what we do that is important. That is where the bird is singing. That is the higher self. And that is where the focus of our meditation should be. We cannot raise up the lower self with the lower self. We have to raise it up from a higher position. And the masters of wisdom hold that position for us until we can make it our own. If we were not that higher self that has come out in our other talks, if we were not that, the unknowable, then the masters wouldn't be spending time with us. They wouldn't trying to help us. But because we have that same potential to walk the same path that they have walked, that we can try to the degree that we can to do the same work that they are doing. It is said that all beings are the same in kind and differ only in degree. So we are helping the masters of wisdom when we shine the light to the degree that we can on all beings, whether they above us or below us, that we are involved in that great work. And we can do that in any condition, including a pandemic, that we have that power. We are that power. That's the key to remember. The self is the power. And if we can look at it and we can change it, then it is not the self. The self, as was said, is the perceiver, the knower. It looks directly upon ideas. And so here we have these sevenfold instruments that are in various conditions and giving us lots of different obstacles and troubles to work through. But the key idea is to remember that we are not those instruments, that we are not the lower iddy, that those are made up of our past, that they are the impressions that we've made upon matter. And now we can take those past impressions and apply the knowledge of self, the wisdom of self. And to do that, to apply the knowledge of self and the wisdom of self, is only through the service of others. It is only through loving deeds. That's the only way that we can discover the self. I don't know about anybody else, but the only way that I can get this lower nature to be quiet and to focus is when it's serving someone. It's the only time it goes quiet. Any other time it's making a lot of noise. It's not focused, it's distracted by so many different directions. But as soon as someone needs help, we can focus it. So then my question then becomes, is that when we don't have someone in front of us that needs our help, when we are living as hermits, that many of us are right now, how do we bring to bear the focus of the meditation? You know, that it's when you don't have someone there in front of you to help, when you don't have, that was a very good question that was asked. And the only way that I can think of that we can do that, that we can consider, is through the example of the elder brothers, through the great teachers, and knowing that we are sevenfold beings. We don't have just the physical plane to work on. We have the mental and the feeling and the desire planes, the plane to work on. And so we can begin our work there and slowly lift up all of nature, which is, nature is that which makes up this sevenfold that we have. So when we attempt to bring it to bear upon an idea in the secret doctrine, or an idea in the Bhagavad Gita, or the voice of the silence, we are in the process of helping, whether we're aware of it or not. Mr. Judge says, don't look for results. They will come of themselves. Oftentimes when people meditate, they're looking for results within the personality. And that is not where we are to be putting our attention at all. The personality is just providing us with the conditions with which to work through. But the real focus is on the eternal pilgrim. It is upon the lifetimes to come. And you can't, if you're a gardener, you can't lift up the plant by the roots every day to see if it's growing. You can't know the results of the meditation. They might not come right away. You might not see them. You might see little indications that you're more patient, you're calmer, you're less reactive. But by and large, their roots are growing stronger within us when we do this work. And the lotus or the flower will bloom, maybe not through this personality or the next one, but it is growing and changing. And as this is said in the Voice of the Silence, that we are creating a robe that we will wear in the future. And the nature of that robe depends on the focus of our meditation. Is that focus of our meditation, is it on our own selfish enlightenment? Then that's the kind of robe that we'll create. And if our meditation is on the desire to be the better able to help and teach others, then we will have an entirely different robe. And that robe will be made up of every department of nature. It will leave nothing out. It will be universal in its application. And therein lies the difficulty for the student that is on that path of meditation. Because we cannot wait until we're in a place of quiet to meditate. We are not supposed to look for a condition to meditate in, but that we should be meditating through all conditions, on acting for and as the self of all creatures, and taking that Kuan Yin pledge that was mentioned, where we will never seek nor receive individual private salvation, but will always strive for the redemption of every creature under the sun. So I can take questions.
Thank you. Any questions or comments for the speaker?
I love you.
I love you too.
Michael.
Shakespeare famously said, to be or not to be.
Yes.
So if we are in beingness or being or becoming, but we are present and we do not, and we try to live in the present, is that a meditation?
Yes, absolutely it is. You know, the Bhagavad Gita points us into the direction that the only way to meditate is to not desire anything from the temporary world. Not at all. Not one thing should we desire from the temporary world. Everything that we, the basis of our actions should come from within, from the paramitas, from the charity, love. We want to radiate those outward onto the physical plane. That is man's duty. Man's duty is to radiate the light of the higher onto the lower. That's our place in nature. And that's the royal talisman, is through that duty. So, yeah, that is to be. And if we are not doing that, then we are not meditating. And if we are not doing that, then the higher self is in a cage and it can warble not. It is banished to the island of Shakespeare's Tempest. Prospero and Miranda are banished from the world. And it is only when the mind starts seeking out that it finds itself on the island with Prospero. And then it can begin the marriage between the Buddhi and the Manus. But as long as our Manus is busy thinking about what it can get, what it wants, what it likes or doesn't like, then we are not meditating. And any other thoughts?
Yes, may I ask a question?
Please do.
If our goal, perhaps that's the wrong word from the get-go, but I'll say it anyway. Our goal is to be bodhisattvas and not to enter the selfish nirvana. Isn't that a goal? And doesn't that taint our meditation?
Yes, it could.
Too?
Yes, it very well could. I think that that's where we have to leave the results to the law. We don't need to rip up the plant to see if it's growing. We don't need to have a desire to get to being a bodhisattva. All we have to do is what is right there in front of us, to shine the virtues without any thought of self, without any thought of result. It is the only way. In fact, and sometimes it's very interesting when you find yourself wanting to help others, and we all have, it's like the brakes get put on the lower nature. It has no room to act. It has no room to maneuver because we have taken the position to help others. And that has its results on the inner planes of our being when we do that. Knowledge is of loving deeds the child. And so that is where knowledge starts to grow. And so we can't look for results. We can't pull that plant up.
Question?
Yes.
So, on the, above the Delphic Oracle, there's part of that statement is, man, know thyself.
Mm-hmm.
How can that be a purpose of our meditation? How can we use that meditation, whether it's daily or a particular practice time, to get to know ourselves better?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the only way this student can answer that at this time would be to say that we can only know who we are through what we are not. And if we can change it, then we are not it. So that, and once it is said that, Buddha said that once we realize that we are not this personality, that we are not this physical self, then it is our duty to understand this personality and physical self thoroughly, to know the dangers of the lower iti, to know the elementals, to understand the nature of the personality. And then through that process of working through these conditions, we can begin to change and transform this lower nature, this personality, into a great Mahatma. I think it was Dallas Tannenbrook that mentioned that once we know that we are not this lower self, that we can turn it into a great Mahatma. Another thing that came to mind in the relationship of our focus was the poem by the writer, the poet, Oliver Wendell Holmes. And he wrote a poem called The Nautilus. And let me see if I can see it in my papers here. Disappeared. Ah, yes. The poem by Oliver Wendell Holmes, The Nautilus. For anyone who hasn't heard it, it is a lovely, most helpful poem. Build thee more stately mansions, O my soul, as the swift seasons roll. Leave thy low vaulted past. Let each new temple, nobler than the last, shut thee from heaven with a dome more vast, till thou at length art free, leaving thine outgrown shell by life's unresting sea. There we see the purpose of meditation. And does anyone have a comment or a question on that?
Steve, I just wanted to say, I see 11 hands that are up, that are raised. Do you see that?
Okay, all right. So, I don't see any hands, but okay. Who do you see, Helene? Call them on.
Okay, let's, all right. I Vicki, I see her hand.
Go ahead, Vicki.
Oh, I just want to thank. This is a really helpful way to consider together, and I appreciate the opportunity, and thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us.
Well,
Joe? Joseph Pugliafito? Are you muted? Okay, while we're waiting for him to unmute.
Jerry? Does Jerry have
Let's see, who's that? Ivania has her hand up. Did Ivania have something to say from New York? No, she doesn't have to say it anymore. The dancers, Tunje has her hand up. Did you want to say something? No? Tom, nothing? Really? I thought you had your hand
Does
up.
Does anybody have a question?
I had a question earlier.
I did have a question a little bit earlier. I was thinking about
we'll take questions to the earlier speakers too. Okay.
Now I have a question about what Laura had talked about, shedding light from the sun through ourselves from the sun, which reminded me of what the voice of the silence says about lighting all but taking light from none.
Yeah.
And the third paramita, talking about harmony in meditation with respect to helping others and so forth. It tells me that we need to be cognizant of where the other is too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I was just thinking about. How do we deal with all that in our meditations and actually going out and doing the best things for others in the helping and teaching?
Well, the only power that we have can never be taken away from us, and nor can we get it from anybody else. And that is the power of the sun. That is the power of the higher self. You cannot get it from anyone else, and it can never be taken away from you, regardless of your condition. And so that is what we have to seek out. I remember reading of a Canadian who was tortured in Iran. And when he came back, he said that he would never trade that experience for anything, because through that time in the Iranian jail, he discovered who he really was. He found his true power, and he realized that he couldn't get it from anyone else, and it could never again be taken away from him.
Thank you very much.
Elaine?
We're going to take a 20-minute now we'll start again at 3 o'clock. The program will be on, so you can chat with one another. Now, we would suggest, for some reason, we're not getting the hands up signals. If I don't seem to be responding to you, I apologize, but try sending a chat either to everyone or to the host, and we'll be better able to recognize your question at that time. So at this time, we'll take our break. We hope you can continue with us the second half. It promises to be very informative and practical based on everything we've heard so far.